today I'm talking with Nick Walsh of the Toronto band Famous Underground and formerly of Slick Toxic. How are you doing today?
Very good, Benita. Thank you. How are you?
I'm really great. Thanks a lot. And we're going to talk about your new project and the new album that's just came out, which is self-titled. And let's talk about that name. It was formerly Revolver for about a decade. Why Famous Underground? Where did it come from?
Well, basically, you know, we had been called Revolver, or myself and Laurie Ann Green, the bass player and my business partner in this, we've been called Revolver since, like, I guess 2002 or something like that. And, you know, it was one of those names that was synonymous with a lot of other things on the planet, such as a magazine in the States. Then Velvet Revolver came out. There was a band called Revolver from England that was more like a what they called shoegazer music, which is like Radiohead and stuff. So unfortunately, we'd already been building a fan base with that name. And what happened was just that last fall, we were getting contacted by a bunch of international press agencies such as AOL Music, and they were wanting product and interviews with us because apparently we were playing at CMJ in New York City. So we did some research and found out that a band from France, which is kind of like a sort of acoustic Beatles type of band, had signed a deal with Astralworks and released a major record last August. And if you went to their YouTube page in the early September when we found this out, they already had like a million views of their first video. So we thought now is a good time for rebranding. We also had a few new band members that we hadn't played with before, and we were just getting ready to, you know, put finishing touches on a new record. So it came about very quickly, and we're happier for it. As for where the name came from, we were in a conversation, my wife, myself, and my guitar player, and he was just mentioning something about how, you know, he couldn't believe that, you know, we were playing together and all this stuff, that he was a fan before. And I was just laughing, saying, you know, what are you talking about? We're on the same level. We're this. And my wife says, oh, Nick's Famous Underground. And I just thought, wow, that is so cool. Now, that was about a year ago. And I thought, I'm going to write that down. Who knows? It could be something in the future, like a clothing line or something crazy like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the situation that happened in the fall with the needing of a band name change, that just fits so aptly. So here we are. We're called FU, Famous Underground.
Yeah, it's really added to the dynamic of the band, because that was the first thing I thought of, was the whole FU symbolization. Like, how perfect is that for rock and metal?
Oh, I know. And, you know, that wasn't anything that came on purpose. It just so happened that's the actual initials of the band. And it's a great sort of a great way. You know, there's a lot of bands that people call them by the initials of the band or whatever, like Avenged Sevenfold, you know, A7X or whatever, you know, all these bands, 3 Days Grace, and they three times, you know, they've got all these 3DG, all this stuff.
Right.
FU is just so, like you say, perfect for rock and metal.
It says it all. It just says it all.
Yeah.
So many people have wondered why you don't try to revive Slick Toxic, which I have to say had a future that was unfortunately snuffed out way too early.
Yeah.
If you had to compare the two bands, what does Famous Underground offer that Slick Toxic didn't?
Well, Slick Toxic was a band that was put together when I was very young. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the early incarnation of the band, I was like 17 years old. And, you know, it was made up of five guys that were very young, very hungry, very eager, but at the same time who had not experienced a lot of life. And, you know, as things progress and people get a little older and their ideals and their ideas change and their influences change, you know, with this band, it's a little bit more, there's a stronger foothold because we are a little bit more experienced. We are more, I love using these words, experienced and wise. That's just a sort of cloak for saying old. But seriously, you know, with Slick Toxic, a lot smaller influences from the world and from the world of music and everything, whereas now there's such a broader sense of knowledge to pull your resources from. And, you know, with the sound of Famous Underground, I think it's a little bit more diverse in the sense that we've taken elements of, you know, great elements of rock and metal over the last few decades and sort of bundled it into what, you know, our sound is. Whereas with Slick Toxic, like I said, it was a younger band with younger influences and so forth. So a lot easier to pigeonhole that sound into a specific thing, whereas with Famous Underground, I think it'll appeal to a broader audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and grunge came in. You know, you guys were just really coming onto the scene, Slick Toxic.
Yeah.
When all of a sudden grunge popped up and it changed the industry for everybody. And today I think you're seeing everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And I think that's the beauty of the independent scene. There's some bands that are doing grunge. There's some bands that are doing metal. There's some bands that are doing death metal, like just anything goes. So I think you're right. It, you know, you just take all that experience and knowledge from what you've learned and your different styles that you've articulated from your past works. And you just bring it forward with something better.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned grunge, and for us with Slick, the situation was as follows. The album was done like a year before it was released, and, you know, it sat on the shelf for a year waiting for a simultaneous release in the U.S. and Canada, and if it had come out previous to its release date, I mean, it would have come out before Guns N' Roses released Use Your Illusions 1 and 2, would have come out before Slave to the Grind by Skid Row. So it really would have filled a void, and things might have been different for the success of the band. However, when it did come out, you know, just a few months later, there was all this hubbub about the Seattle scene happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that sort of put to rest a lot of the what we'll call the sort of 80s style rock or what they call today hair metal bands.
Right.
And but I'll tell you, the truth of it is, you know, I'm kind of glad it happened because it sort of cleaned up a bunch of stuff. I found that at that time music was, within our genre anyway, was starting to get very cookie cutter, very corporate. You know, you had labels putting out bands that were put out solely on their looks as opposed to their talent and things like that.
Very true.
And when grunge hit, it was, again, not really so much about a lot of talent because there was a lot of guys in that couldn't play. I mean, hence the whole let's not do guitar solos anymore thing that was going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of great music came out of it that influenced me as well, such as Alice in Chains, Chris Cornell and Soundgarden, Stone Temple Pilots. There were some great groups to come out of that era that are still prevalent today. And, you know, you can find elements of some of the stuff that killed my old music. You can find some of those elements in my new music. Because whatever's good is good, and that's the bottom line.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got that right. So you've been playing with bassist Lori Ann Green for a while now, and I must say, and I hope she hears this, she is phenomenal. Like, I just think your chemistry on stage from the footage I've seen, it's perfect. To see a strong, spirited female up there is always a good thing. That's okay. How did this collaboration between the two of you first start?
Well, basically, this is what I was going to get into, is that when I was in between Slick Toxic and, let's say, the Revolver Famous Underground project, I had put together a band called Raised on Mars, which didn't last too long. It was about a year and a half, and it consisted of Rob Bruce, ex-Slick Toxic guy, Franz Messini, who was the bass player, the original bass player by Mother Earth, a few different guys. And Lori had a band called Jane Doe that was on the Toronto scene. And they were all-female bands, sort of more along the lines of sort of metal, industrial kind of stuff. And I really just liked the band and took a shine to them. So I had invited them to play some dates with us. And we just became friends after that. And as the years went by, I always was trying to court Lori into playing with me because I really liked the dynamic of having a female in the band, because I felt that it brought, again, a broader audience and appreciation. Because you know, as much as I'm the songwriter, the main songwriter of the band, if I went out with a solo name, if I called the band Nick Walsh, then I'd be limiting myself to people who either love me or hate me.
Very true.
When you have a band dynamic and you have different characters that people can associate with and or be gravitating towards, then they may like the band as a whole as opposed to just saying yes or no. And, you know, I always wanted Lori to play with me, and the timing just happened to be right that when I did call her when I was starting the Revolver project, she said, oh, good timing. You know, Jane Doe just broke up about a month ago, and I was going to start looking for a project to play with. And the rest is history. So there you have it.
Well, it's perfect. I think vocally, you guys fit like a lock and key from everything I've heard. And like I said, it just... it's great to see that female up there. That's
true. And I'll tell you, with my type of voice and everything, having a female background singer is great because, like you were saying, like the melding of the two voices on stage, a lot of people think it sounds like me. So, you know what I mean? It's like the records. It's, you know, on the records, I do predominantly most of my own harmonies. And the fact that she can translate that live and, you know, even if we're doing an acoustic version of one of our songs like On Broken Wings or something like that, the voices blending together, just people are just like, wow, it's real.
Actually, it's funny you mention that because I happened to catch you on Being Young with Astrid Young on FM. And that was just remarkable. That song On Broken Wings was just, the harmonies were so beautiful.
Thank you.
It was amazing. So let's talk now about mentioning the other members, what they're bringing to the table. How have the live shows been going?
Well, the live shows have been going great. I mean, in assembling this unit, it's sort of been a situation where because, again, we've been through a lot of different experience, had a lot of different players, the main thing was we have to make sure that we have a synergy and can get along as people before anything else. Because when you've had experience, I mean, obviously we know coming to the table, you have to be a good player. You have to be a good musician if you're going to even attempt to do what we're doing on the level that we're doing it at. And the main thing is that we've managed to find some people that are just great people. And obviously they're great musicians or else they wouldn't be with us. So the dynamic, especially live, has been fantastic because we have a good time. If we weren't having a good time doing music, we wouldn't be doing it. As you know, we're not in it for the money, obviously, because we've been doing it for so long, and it's not like we're having parties at Hugh Hefner's place. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
yeah. So, you know, we're in it because we like the music, and we're in it because we enjoy performing, and that's the bottom line. And because we are having such a good time doing it, and the guys that we're playing with, it's going great. And we really, really want to try to get out across Canada, Western Canada. We seem to have a great little fan base that's kind of screaming for us to get out that way.
I could see that, because when I first seen the video you have up on the web for Overdrive.
Yes.
Holy man. My first thought was, it's great to see that Nick is still rocking as hard as he did back in the day. And then I thought, I've got to see these guys live. I have to, because there was just, like you said, just energy and cohesiveness and synergy between all of you. Remarkable.
Well, see, that's what the whole performance aspect as well as the tightness of a band is all about, is the synergy. And, you know, even in a rehearsal situation, you know, there's good days and there's bad days, but the good days, you know, because you're connecting on a totally different level that you can't even explain to people. And when you're bringing that to the stage and that sort of thing is happening on stage, it's not difficult for the audience to feel it and get involved with it and you know, sort of transfer their energy back to us. And that's really what it's about. And you know, it's one thing to go up there and just play songs. But if you're feeling the songs and you're passionate about the songs, then the audience feels like they're involved in the songs. They're involved in the performance. And that's what we try to do when we go out there and play live, is make sure that it's sort of, let's see how big of an energy ball we can create tonight. You know what I mean? With the audience, whether there's five people or about social networking and the internet is it's all about connecting. And connecting is the key to, you know, everything on this planet. So, you know, why not with music too? So,
yeah, exactly. So speaking of yourself, like, you are one of the most dramatic, you know, frontmen that I have seen. And lots of expression goes on with you, plus your the vocal height you can reach is amazing. How have you maintained your continuity with your own voice over the course of the last 25 years?
Well, basically, you know, as much as I don't sit down and listen to specific records or anything like that anymore, like when I was younger, but I still have my old faithfuls that I practice to for maintaining my voice. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the dramatic sense. It's true. And you know, a lot of the influences as a stage performer for me growing up were these guys that were a little bit more into the shock rock bands like Kiss, Alice Cooper, King Diamond. And basically, I'm doing the same sort of expression without having, like, my face painted. You know what I'm saying?
It's true, though. You're right.
Sorry?
I said it's true. You're right.
Yeah, I'm doing the same sort of almost thespian-like acting or whatever to the words of the songs and how the music moves me and engaging the audience in that sense, but I'm not dressed in the theatrical sort of hide-behind-a-cloak kind of thing. It's me. This mm-hmm. is me. And this is how I feel it. This is how I project it. And, you know, if I wasn't doing that, then I would be, like, standing with my back to the audience.
And, you know, it's funny because I have seen some acts, I'm not going to mention names, but yeah. Where the frontman has just literally stood there and sang. And I tell you, there is nothing more disappointing to a fan that disconnects a fan right off the bat is a frontman that does not give that energy to the audience
and
put the expression behind the lyrics and the music that has been written.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. I can't even say anything else to you about that other than I agree 100%.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to see that? Boring.
Well, you might as well just stay home and put the record on and close your eyes and think of something else, you know what I mean?
Well, and it's about feeling that music. You know, if you've created that music and you really feel are in touch with that music, you should be able to get up there and not have to worry, am I hitting this note right? Am I a little off tonight? You should just be able to be expressionistic and let it flow naturally.
Well, yeah, it just comes out. It should just come out of you. I mean, as a singer, sure, we have our difficult nights where if we've been singing a couple of nights in a row or lack of water, lack of sleep, whatever. I mean, our body is our instrument. However, the passion that projects all that, if you still have that, then you will come across whether you hit that high note that everybody was expecting or not. The point is that it's all about expression. And, you know, I've heard a lot of singers duck notes and not sing it exactly like the record, but sometimes it doesn't matter because they're not taking anything away from the passion. And that's really what counts. So
how have you kept your range? Like, how have you managed to keep your range? Because as you get older, your voice naturally deepens.
Mm-hmm.
How have you managed to stay on top of that?
Well, basically, like I was saying earlier, I still practice to a bunch of the same sort of singers that influenced me growing up, like Rob Halford of Judas Priest, King Diamond, Bruce Dickinson, Queensryche. Like these bands, as much as, like I said, I don't sit down and listen to them like, oh, yeah, I'm right into hearing Painkiller every day, I'll still practice to it and maintain a healthy lifestyle. You know, I eat well. I try to make sure that I'm hydrated. I don't dehydrate myself. I don't, you know, it's a lot different. You know, when I was 20 years old and you're going on the road, it's all about the party. And as you get a little older, it starts to become more about the music and, you know, maintaining a healthy lifestyle. And as a singer that's done it for many years, the best advice I can give anybody young is, as a singer, is make sure that you drink lots of water, get a lot of sleep, and eat right, because your body is your instrument and you have to take care of that, or else. It's not like the guitar player who can get completely rotted the night before a gig and, you know, the next day it doesn't matter if he has a voice left, he's got his fingers still, you know. It'd be like, you know, partying, for example, as a singer all night and then having to do a show the next day would much be like a guitar player putting his hands in a vise or something and squeezing it for hours on end and smashing it and punching walls and stuff and then expecting to be able to play guitar later that night. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard Bruce Dickinson often comment about that and say, you know, as boring as it seems, he's the first one back to the hotel room because he's got to rest his voice.
That's it. You got to, you know, the first thing I do, I don't care if it's 100 degrees outside, is after a show, I wrap my throat with a scarf, keep my cords warm so that they can, you know, settle to the temperatures around me at a reasonable rate. You know, I find it very hard to sleep when I'm on the road in different places because after a show I'm all pumped up on adrenaline. So one of the things, as corny as this may sound, white noise is what puts me to sleep. So I have a little, one of those little things like a clock radio that plays the sounds of waves or rain and stuff just so that I can try to calm my nerves, because adrenaline on stage, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, our body produces this thing that just pumps us right up, and it's so difficult to come down. And that's why a lot of bands and artists out there are on drugs and alcohol, is because they need something to perk them up and then they need something to bring them down.
Yeah.
You know, that was the cause of Elvis Presley's death. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're also a producer and you've worked with a multitude of other artists. What do you think is the primary element that takes great production to exceptional production?
I think ultimately, at the end of the day, it's one thing for a producer, for people to base a producer off of, you know, going in the studio and getting some great sounds. But to me, that's a great engineer. A great producer needs a great engineer to translate the ideas that, or the vision of the band and the producer into sound. Now, a great producer, I believe, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of different guys in my past, and the only way I can equate it is if you were a writer or an actor in a movie, and you've got to work with some great guys, Martin Scorsese, you know, the list, Steven Spielberg, the list goes on. If you got to work with these great directors, I think you're going to pick up a thing or two, and eventually you're going to want to direct your own film. And that's kind of like what it's been like for me growing up. You know, I've been in recording studios since I was like 14, 15 years old. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with great engineers and great producers and learn from each and every one of them something. And ultimately, I think the producer's main job is to make sure that those songs that the artist is bringing into the studio are honed as best as everybody feels confident and comfortable with. And when I go in to produce a band, I usually strip a song right down to its basic element. They can play me a song and I go, yeah, I can hear something here, but let's start with the kick drum. You know what I mean? Let's mm-hmm. start with the vocal melody. Let's start with the guitar part. Let's lock in the bass and drums, because what you guys are doing are cool, but it's not synced up. You want to be tight. You want to get this happening. And to me, that's what makes exceptional production, is that when you know that the producer has actually sat down, picked apart the songs, built them back up with the band, and then gone in to get great sound quality and great tones through the board and all the equipment, and that translation is just undeniable.
You can really see that happening in the Famous Underground CD. That was one thing that I first noted the first time I listened to it, was it's very equally balanced. Sometimes you get discs and the drums are way too loud, or it's just too guitar driven, or too much vocalist going on. This was very equally balanced.
Well, thank you. Thank you for noticing. Yeah. Well, it took a long time. It was a long process. I, you know, with my close friend friends and family, as well as some of the fans that are a little bit more eager that I kind of correspond with. A lot of people are saying, "Oh, this is like your Chinese Democracy. We've been waiting forever for this record," you know. But you know, over the years, it's taken a few years, and over the years of sort of recording and mixing and doing test mixes and re-recording, there's been so much stuff that has come and gone in those songs. Only because you have time. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to, I owned a commercial recording studio here in Toronto for many years of the 2000s, just closed the doors a couple of years ago. I had the luxury of not having to look at a clock when I was writing and recording my stuff. So what that did was create the never-ending project.
Yeah.
You eventually have to put a deadline on yourself so you can move on and get closure. And so I can write more songs and record more songs, because nothing will ever be finished in an artist's mind until somebody else tells them that it has to be finished.
You're your own worst critic, for
sure.
Absolutely.
And that's pretty much why the record sounds the way it does. I don't regret taking so long, because I feel that all the strip downs and re-records or redo this track or do a new vocal on this, or change the lyrics and redo the vocal on that, or whatever the case may be. I think it was all for the better, and, you know, but eventually, like I said, a deadline had to be put on, so Lori and I made sure that we said, okay, we want to definitely put this out pre-summer 2011, and we went gangbusters at the early part of this year, 2011, to get that done.
So what were the big challenges with this album?
So the big challenges for us was consistency. With the Revolver Band and our Turbulence album, it was an album that was recorded in stages. And when I say that, I mean like even the drum sessions and stuff. So it was really hard to get sonic consistency. And for this record, that's what we really wanted to get for the songs, because we felt the songs were strong. We were very proud of what we had written and arranged. But we wanted to make sure that when you put on the record, the listener hears song to song a consistency to say, hey, this record sounds like A, the same band, B, like it was done at the same studio with the same instruments. And you know what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That was our biggest challenge, and I think we achieved that based off of even what you've just said with your experience listening to it for the first time.
Okay. And so what are the plans for promotion and touring?
Well, right now we're just in the process of editing our video for the song Dead Weight, which is going really well, and we hope to have that done by the end of this month. We did some preliminary dates start of May, right up till the end of this month. We've got some more shows till the end of June. Then we don't really plan on doing too many shows, maybe a couple of one-offs throughout the summer, and get right back to it in the fall, because, you know, at this stage we are a club level band, and playing the clubs in the summer isn't a very good idea, because it creates tensions between promoters, bands, management, and club owners, only to the fact that, you know, a lot of people go away for weekends, you know, to the cottage or the trailer, or they want to go outside and be on a patio or that kind of thing, that you're not really going to draw big numbers in the club scene in the summertime. And we want to hold off on that until September, when people start to go back inside to check out entertainment and have their beverages.
How has the club scene been doing in Toronto?
Well, it's a lot different than it used to be. There's no rock and roll heaven, gasworks, and all that kind of stuff anymore. What I found was, you know, throughout the 90s, what we touched on earlier with the whole grunge thing and all that, when Perry Farrell, the lead singer of Jane's Addiction, started his Lollapalooza touring, he had a very eclectic sort of idea for a festival. And the problem I find with clubs and promoters in the clubs is, from that mentality back then, they've tried to cater to multifaceted genres of music in order to get 50 people in for this band, and then there's a country band next, and then 50 new people show up. When I was playing in the clubs with Slick Toxic, it was all about a scene and creating a scene. And the only way to create a scene is to have like-minded bands, like-minded fans and individuals to want to be a part of something. And if you're going to a club and the band you're going to see is on at 10 o'clock, but before that there's a hip-hop artist, well, the odds are you're going to go have a drink somewhere else. And then you go, okay, well, our band's on at 10, so we'll get to the club about 10 to 10. That band should be off that we don't want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And then when our band's off, we'll split and go somewhere else because the band after that, I'm not interested in either. And that's where I think there's a big downfall in creating a scene in the club circuit, because that's what's going on. Promoters aren't trying to create a specific scene and a genre. Like, it should be. If you're having a rock band on a Friday night, make it rock night and have three rock bands, not a rock band and then a pop band and then a single female with an acoustic guitar. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, it probably.
I don't know what it's like where you are. You're in Saskatchewan, right?
Yes, it's.
What city are you in? Saskatoon.
I'm in Moose Jaw, and it's pretty limited. Our downtown district has just went through some changes in development, and they're putting a new arena down there.
Which city? I didn't hear you.
Moose Jaw?
Oh, Moose Jaw. Okay.
Yes. Yes. The home.
I've never played there.
Well, you need to come.
Yeah. Awesome.
Home of the Snowbirds. That's what we're known for. And we're the friendly city, although some might disagree with me.
I am. I said, that's nice.
Okay. So, here's a question for you.
Okay.
Do you think the record deal is dead with so much independent music?
Yes, I do. And when I say that, I don't say it with any sort of contempt or anything. It's not like I'm like, because I don't have a major deal right now, I'm saying that. I'm saying that because it's a fact. Nowadays, with what's going on with technology and how the industry scrambled for so long to try to secure the CD, which was a very stupid thing that they tried to do, instead of embracing technology and taking ownership of technology, they wanted to squash it. I mean, as an example, when I was a teenager in high school, we used to make mixtapes all the time.
Right.
We'd have records and we'd put on our favorite artists and we'd hand them to our buddies and whatnot. That's no different than MP3 sharing. The only difference is the MP3 quality is much better than what the cassette tape was. So for them to squash something and live in fear for it, by it rather, was stupid. They should have embraced the technology. It wasn't up until even like a year or so ago, bands like AC/DC weren't even on iTunes. So what does that tell you? Now the industry is looking for different streams, revenue streams, and they don't have as much money as they used to. As an example, EMI Publishing. I mean, 5 years ago, EMI Publishing here in Toronto had about, 30 employees or so in the office. Now they're down to one. So that's a good example and a good indication as to where the industry is going. Same thing happened with, the idea of CD stores. HMV, as you notice, has sort of turned more into, movies and DVDs. And I think they're carrying video games now. Virgin Megastores in Europe have already gone with the CDs. Bye-bye CDs. Now we're just carrying literature and DVDs and video games. And eventually that's going to go too because it's all digital.
You're right.
So the day of the record deal, they're only signing a couple artists a year. And sure, there are bands out there that are getting the deals and getting promoted for the length of the record and possibly drop the next year. It's such a big market out there now. If we all just learn to love the internet and try to get direct marketing, which is directly to the fans and to the fans that we know will like us, meaning if you know that you're a death metal guy, you're going to go after the fans of all the biggest death metal artists and so forth. So it's about that kind of sale. Direct marketing sales is what it's all about now. You don't need as much money. It's not like it used to be. You don't need to go press up 1,000 CDs and have them sitting in your closet and only sell 50 of them at your gig and you're stuck with 950, or sending them all out to record companies or radio stations. Now with MP3s and things like Reverb Nation and Sonic Bids and all these different online things and iTunes to sell your music, really, what do you need? The only thing a record company really would ultimately be good for is their money.
Yeah, for touring and promotion.
For touring and for marketing yourself in, let's say, the regular Joe territories,
mm-hmm.
you know, like meaning print medias and stuff like that. But as far as online is concerned, it's all at our fingertips. You don't need to move now. You can make it from your own backyard.
And there is some phenomenal stuff out there, some really great stuff out there. I love working with independent artists because it just takes you into a whole nother world of music that you never knew existed. And I always encourage people to get out there and see what's happening in the independent scene.
For sure. Like, you know, support local talent, support, regional and national talent, world talent. The bottom line is there's so much out there that gets sort of pushed by the wayside because people just don't know it's there. They don't know it exists. And that's the number one key is, especially now, is just try to make sure people know you exist. And if you're good, then you'll do okay. Think of it like this. If you are an independent artist and you're on iTunes and you sell a record for $9.99, if you sell 10,000 of those, that's $100,000. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's not rocket science. If you have one single that's a 99-cent download, you sell 10,000, there's $10,000. Like, this is a big deal because you don't have to pay back anything. The day of the record deal, with a record deal, you're paying back a recoupable. A label signs you to a $250,000 record deal. They spend $50,000 on your record. They give you $50,000 in tour support. They spend $50,000 on a video, $50,000 in marketing, and the band gets $50,000 to take 6 months off to devote their time to selling the record. Well, at the end of the day, when you sell one record, you're not seeing a dime of it. It's going back to the label to pay back the $250,000 you just borrowed from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works. It's like a loan, realistically.
Yeah, that's very true. So now we're going to have a little bit of fun. I'm going to give you the names of some iconic artists from Canada.
Okay.
And in one to two words, you're going to give me the first thought that comes to mind upon hearing their names.
Okay, but I'm not doing it on a time thing. It's not.
No, not a time thing.
So,
are you ready?
I'm ready.
The Guess Who.
Awesome.
April.
Innovators.
April Wine.
Hit songs.
Bryan Adams.
Hit songs and a lot of energy. Can I just tell you something about Bryan Adams?
Yes, absolutely.
I remember when I was about 12 years old or something, a friend of mine's mom, her brother worked for Loverboy. And Loverboy was coming to Toronto with this guy, this unknown guy named Bryan Adams as the opening. And we had six row floors. I was like 12 years old. I saw this guy performing, and I'll tell you, I was changed. I knew that guy was going to be a superstar. The energy and the passion that Bryan Adams carries with him is unlike any. It's incredible.
If you
ever get a chance to see him live, I don't know what he's like now, but, you know, even if you get to see any of the old footage or whatever he's doing, energy, amazing.
He's still selling out Europe, so I think he's got to be damn good.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, the Tragically Hip.
Tragically Hip. Iconic Canadian, very Canadian.
Helix.
Helix, again, very iconic, influential Canadian hard rock and metal band. When I was a kid, I got the record No Rest for the Wicked, and I was just like, I loved it. Songs like Heavy Metal Love, Does a Fool Ever Learn, love them.
Timeless. They're really timeless.
Absolutely.
I think they are. And I've had the pleasure to meet those guys, and they are just a really great bunch of guys.
Yeah, we did a show with them last year, and I I'd met them years before that, but we did a show with them last year. It was great. And one of my ex-guitar players from Revolver, Sean Kelly, actually is working with them. He's done some production for them.
That's right. That's right. Here's another one. Anvil.
Again, success story of the year. Come on, what else is there to say? These guys have been slugging it out, beating the crap out of the scene for many, many years. You know, it's great to see that they're actually able to go out there and do what they love doing. A couple of years ago, I remember they couldn't even get 50 people to a club in downtown Toronto, and now they're touring with Alice Cooper, played with AC/DC. They're playing with the best of them. They deserve it, man. These guys have been, they're true rock soldiers, and there's not a lot of us left.
No, I just actually caught up with Anvil a few weeks back in Regina, and I had never seen them before, and of course wanted to speak to them because it's Anvil. Like, they're a phenomenon right now.
Yeah.
And honest to God, and I'm not just saying this because they're from Canada, because I had the privilege of going into their show, one of the best live acts I have ever seen in my life.
Awesome.
They thrashed. Here's one.
Awesome.
Nickelback.
Nickelback. Very underrated based on the whole cool factor. I think that, you know, I don't care what anybody says. I will defend Nickelback because, you know, they came from an independent level and came out of nowhere and kicked people right in the face. And they got to make it stateside and, you know, produce lots of records. So many records that, you know, they also produced a bunch of sound-alikes. And that's a good thing. You know, when other bands sound like you, you're onto a good thing.
Yeah, they tapped into a formula, that's for sure.
Well, that's absolutely for sure, but it's a formula that worked. I mean, if you sell, all I can say is this. If you sell 10 million records, or I don't know how many they sold now, 50 million, whatever. Let's say 10 million records, 10 million people can't be wrong. So the one naysayer who carves them up, just like somebody who carves up Justin Bieber, they're just jealous, really, because it takes talent. And, you know, when you're playing with guys like Carlos Santana or guys from Pantera, like if you can go from country to metal to this hip-hop and be respected by these people who are your peers, well, then you're on to something good.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I'm proud to have Nickelback as a Canadian band, just as I'm proud to have Celine Dion as a Canadian artist, because I'll tell you something about being a Canadian artist. We live in a big country with nobody in it.
And, you got that right.
And because of that, we strive very hard to make sure that we're damn good at what we do, because we're competing on the world market. And if some of us can make it on that world market, make a name for ourselves, and bring the eyes and focus and attention to this country, well, then my hat's off to you.
For sure. Here's another one. Alanis Morissette.
Again, same thing. Very talented woman. That first record that she put out after her Diva Dance days when she was younger proved that she was a true artist. She wrote those songs, and that's what counts. I mean, I think she's an icon now, too.
She's a brilliant songwriter.
Absolutely.
Triumph.
Keep going. Triumph. Again, same thing. Here was a band back in the early, early days, like the late 70s, playing on the club circuit, doing stuff that nobody did before. They had the huge light show. They did all this stuff. And, you know, they ended up making it stateside. And all I can say is, us festival, hello.
And Rick Emmett with that double neck guitar.
Oh, yeah, and a voice, too, right?
Oh.
Emmett Gilmore. Doing vocals, they both had great, great voices. And the thing is, they produced songs that, you know, could have been done by two different artists, but they had each singer in the same band. So
yeah,
everything from the Gilmore stuff to the Rick Emmett stuff, great songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Kim Mitchell.
Fantastic guy, fantastic player, very underrated. He was shredding on the guitar long before Yngwie. You know, if it wasn't for guys like Kim Mitchell in the early days, I don't know where guitar would have went. Because, you know, Kim Mitchell at that time, in the early days of Max Webster, they were almost like a bit of the Frank Zappa of Canada, which takes a lot of technical skill to do.
Absolutely.
Let alone write some great hooky stuff. I had the chance and opportunity to tour with Kim back with Slick, and not only is he a fantastic player, but a great guy.
Yes, he really is. I've interviewed Kim, and I guess my two words for him, literally, would be guitar god. You're right, he is so underrated.
Underrated. They don't realize, but what a shredder, man. That guy was a shredder before shredding was invented. And I'm really sorry, Benita, but I'm finding it very hard to just give you one or two word answers on it.
That's okay. As long as we're running over time, but if you're okay with it, I'm okay with it.
I don't mind at all, as long as people don't lose interest.
Exactly. Rush.
What can you say about Rush? Same thing at, like, Triumph. These are guys that, you know, were playing in they were playing Toronto high schools. And when they put out Working Man and got, you know, started getting airplay in the States and everything, I mean, hats off. This is a band that, because they're Canadian, sure, they get a lot of radio play, but this is a band that really didn't make it on radio play. This is a band that has a very unique underground following who still follow them up to this day. They still sell out shows. And great players, so.
BTO.
Love them. I love them, love them, love them. I, you know, you said the Guess Who to start with, but I am more of a Bachman Turner Overdrive fan. Always have been since I was a kid. You know, certain songs when I was a kid just used to get me by that band. They were heavy. They were, like, in the, when I was a toddler or whatever, kid in the mid to late 70s, those songs were heavy, heavy stuff.
That's right. Because we were coming out of an era where it was like the Osmonds and the Carpenters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're around the same age, so don't be giving that away.
I won't.
Okay. Neil Young.
Neil Young. Iconic, fantastic songwriter. I'm a huge fan of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Just a huge fan. You know, a lot of people can say what they want about Neil. He's very unique sounding, his voice and so forth. But the songwriting ability from that guy and the diversity from that guy are just amazing. And again, he is a Canadian icon, and he deserves to be right up there with all of the, I'll call them the vintage masters.
Yep, absolutely. He just went into the Hall of Fame, I believe, right?
Well, I know they honored him at the Junos with like a lifetime achievement thing.
Right.
I didn't know about the Hall of Fame, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, he you're right, diverse. That absolutely says it all. Because he can take any song he writes and tailor it for certain people.
So if he goes from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and then he goes to having a record like Harvest, then he puts out the Shocking Pinks. You know, I mean, come on. He goes from a doo-wop record to a folk record to a... That's, you know, amazing. A guy who didn't paint himself into one corner, who reinvents himself, that's amazing.
Okay, last one, Billy Talent.
Billy Talent, fantastic band, love them. Energy, passion, and great songwriting, great production, top-level entertainment. What do you want? You know, you can't very say too much more than that.
So, out of this list, who would be your biggest influence and why?
Out of that list?
Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to miss anybody. It was just names that came to my head.
Yeah, I you know, out of all those artists, as much as, honestly, most of those artists are a little bit more indirect to me because I like bits and pieces of them all. But I really couldn't narrow it down because I'm sure I've taken elements of a lot of those people throughout my life growing up. I don't know. I love Randy Bachman. I love April Wine. I just, out of Canadian bands, like rock bands, I don't know. I'd say April Wine, Bachman, Turner, Overdrive out of all those bands.
I would have a tendency to agree. I listened to a lot of April Wine growing up. I had two brothers that were huge into April Wine. I think they were a group that they never got the notoriety that they deserved.
Absolutely. Again, another underrated Canadian band. They were innovators. They had the three guitars, lots of harmony guitars, great songs. had the fortune to, again, back in the Slick days, play with April Wine. And when I watched their show, I just couldn't believe hit after hit after hit. Because I grew up in an era where, you know, the music that was around me, whether I had a record or it was the radio, it was the soundtrack to my life. And when I was 25 or whatever, playing with April Wine, and after I got off the stage and I was fortunate enough to stand at the soundboard and watch their show, every song brought back memories. And that's amazing. That's an unbelievable feat. These guys, you know, are still playing. So,
yeah, it's, especially with everything that went down with Jerry Mercer, too.
Yeah, actually, Neil Busby from Slick Toxic played with them for a while when Jerry was undergoing his therapies.
He was just so intimidating on that kit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just the look of him.
Oh, I know.
Itself was just riveting.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you'd like to add about what Famous Underground is up to or where fans can reach you guys at?
Well, you can obviously go to our website, which is www.famousunderground.tv. Not .com, it's .tv. Famousunderground.tv. And from there, you know, you can launch to your favorite social networking sites, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, you name it. And as far as the future of the band goes, we've just released the CD. It's been out for a few weeks now. And we're just hoping to try to get to as many people as possible because we think it's a matter of awareness. And in this day and age, because it's an independent world, it's a lot more difficult to reach those people, but once you do, you're reaching the right people. So that's what we're hoping to achieve. We have a video for the song Dead Weight that should be out in a few weeks, and we hope you enjoy it.
Wonderful. Well, it is a fantastic CD. I'm telling all the fans out there, you got to go buy it. Famous Underground, F you. And check them out. Check out Nick Walsh and his band from Toronto. Anywhere on the net. They're fabulous.
Thank you so much for the interview, Benita.
Thank you so much, Nick. It was a real pleasure to sit down with you, and I really appreciate you taking this time.
Awesome.